The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 28, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a white narrow inner border. The background for today's Time portrait is in a pale gray, almost an off-white. White is the color of the lettering for Time in large block capital letters. Offset to the right, just a bit, is the photograph. It's a family grouping of four individuals, and the title is The Making of the Pope by Belinda Luscombe, Robert Lewis, and John with their mother Mildred Prevost in Chicago in 1959. The boys in front are dressed probably for church, for mass, I would think, because the two youngest are wearing short pants, striped socks, polished dark shoes. This is a sepia tone, so I can't be sure of the specific colors. Both of them are wearing striped jackets and white shirts with collars, and they are open to fit just right inside those jackets. The older boy is wearing long trousers, dark colored, dark shoes, a light colored, possibly linen jacket, and that's in either a very small light stripe or it's solid in color in a lighter shade, lighter tone. And he's wearing a figured shirt with, again, the collar just spaced right on those lapels. And behind them, their mother, who is dressed simply elegantly for the 1950s. She's wearing a medium-colored suit. Again, this is sepia tone, so it may not be tan as it looks here. She's wearing a fox fur piece. Her shoes are high-heeled, dark pumps, and she's wearing a hat. It's not quite a large-brimmed picture hat, but it's more of a flat picture hat. She's smiling. She has dark eyes. Her dark hair is swept back. She's wearing earrings. She's smiling behind these three little boys. The oldest is grinning at the camera. The second oldest is grinning at the camera. And the smallest, Robert, is just looking straight ahead at the camera with a very serious and intent look. He's holding something in his hand. It looks like it might be an envelope or it might be a prayer card from the Mass. Beginning now with textual items, almost. Mourning, a star, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, a star. This is about a third of a page photograph. It's brightly colored. It's mostly a crowd of people. They're standing behind, they're in a stadium, and the front is draped in red and gold. Several people are holding photographs of a young man whose name is Jota or Hota. Or Jota, I apologize, I do not know the pronunciation. It's J-O-T-A. Fans commemorate Portuguese soccer player Diogo Jota ahead of the Euro 2025 Group B match between Spain and Portugal at Stadion Von Korf in Bern, Switzerland, July 3rd. Jota, or Hota, a 28-year-old Liverpool FC star, and his brother were killed in a car crash in northern Spain earlier that day. Jota, a father of three, had gotten married about 2 weeks before the crash. The bulletin, China opens up to more tourists as Trump closes U.S. off. This is by Miranda Jayaratnam. As the U.S. under President Donald Trump increasingly closes itself off from the world, denying entry to some tourists amid a crackdown on border controls and migration, its geopolitical rival China, which has long been known for its relative isolation, has loosened its travel restrictions to unprecedented levels. China is expanding visa-free entry to 75 countries as part of a broader campaign to boost inbound tourism, which has already seen a surge. Last year, over 200 million foreigners visited China without a visa, doubling the number of the previous year, according to China's National Immigration Administration. China's been steadily pushing for more people to visit since reopening its borders in early 2023, after its zero-COVID policies appeared for a time as though they might drive the country into a lasting isolation. China began expanding its visa-free policy after reopening its borders in 2023. Citizens from much of Europe, Asia, and parts of the Middle East are now able to enter China without a visa and stay for up to 30 days. China has also expanded its transit policy to 55 countries, including Canada, Czech Republic, Indonesia, Lithuania, Mexico, Russia, Sweden, UK, Ukraine, and U.S., which are not part of the visa-free plan, but whose citizens can enter China without a visa for up to 10 days if in transit to another country. The move is part of China's effort to boost its soft power at a time when the Trump administration appears to be withdrawing the U.S. from the global stage. In recent months, Trump has moved to restrict international students from the U.S., and reports of tourists being detained or denied entry by Immigration and Customs Enforcement have also deterred some visitors. During his 2024 campaign, Trump also vowed to reinstate his ban on travelers from Muslim countries. In June, he announced a new travel ban on nationals from 12 countries and tightened restrictions on nationals from 7 more. He's reportedly considering adding 36 countries to the travel ban list. The brief news, good question. Why are rural hospitals closing? By Alana Samuels, Thomasville, Alabama. There's a small photo here of a building. It looks like a one-story brick building with a big front lawn, very grassy and green. And there's a sign that says Thomasville Regional Medical Center, emergency with an arrow, main entrance with an arrow, surgery patient pickup with another arrow, and in front of the sign, hospital closed. And that's the Thomasville, Alabama hospital closed after just 4 years. Thomasville Regional Medical Center was supposed to be a game changer, situated in the U.S. Congressional District with the worst health outcomes in the country. The hospital opened in 2020 with state-of-the-art equipment, including a 3D mammogram and an MRI scanner, but it closed less than 5 years later, in September 2024. The hospital now stands empty, its pristine hallways dark, its expensive machines gathering dust. It's almost like the apocalypse happened, says Thomasville's mayor, Sheldon Day, who worked for almost a decade to get a hospital to open there. This apocalypse is happening throughout the country. More than 100 rural hospitals have closed in the past decade, according to the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform, CHQPR, a national policy center that works to improve healthcare payment systems. About one-third of all rural hospitals in the country are at risk of closing because of financial problems. In Alabama alone, 23 rural hospitals, about half the number in the whole state, are at immediate risk of closing, according to CHQPR. Even more are in trouble with the passage of the sweeping new federal budget reconciliation law, which includes cuts that will slash Medicaid spending in rural areas. Tom Tillis, the U.S. Senator from North Carolina, who voted against the bill, said in a June 28 statement that Congress should achieve the cuts in the legislation without hurting our rural communities and hospitals. People often blame rural hospital closures on poor reimbursement rates from Medicare and Medicaid. There's a reason for that assumption. Just about every hospital loses money on Medicaid and Medicare since reimbursement rates are low nationwide. But hospitals like the one in Thomasville are struggling not because they serve a large share of poor patients or elderly people on these plans. When you look at the data, what you see is Medicare and Medicaid are not the problem, says Harold Miller, president and CEO of CHQPR. The problem is private insurers. Rural hospitals depend on private insurers for the majority of their patient costs, Miller says. In Alabama, for instance, CHQPR's data show patients with private insurance rack up 65% to 80% of patient costs in Alabama's rural hospitals. In Thomasville, 18.4% of patients were using Medicare to pay for their coverage, 16.2% were using Medicaid, and 65.4% were using private insurance. But many rural hospitals are losing money on what private insurers will pay for patient care. The one in Thomasville, for instance, was getting paid by private insurers roughly half of what it was costing to deliver services, according to CHQPR. Urban hospitals and large rural hospitals are able to make up for the losses from Medicare and Medicaid patients with what they charge private insurers, Miller says. Small rural hospitals cannot do that. They require even higher compensation than urban hospitals because they have the same fixed costs, like 24-hour staffing, but a lower volume of patients to cover those costs. One reason small hospitals get less money, insurers demand discounts. Larger hospitals have more leverage to negotiate with private insurers over those discounts because they have higher patient volumes. Smaller hospitals have less wiggle room to negotiate. Challenges facing rural hospitals nationwide have gotten worse in the past year or two, Miller says, because costs have gone up after the pandemic as labor became scarce. The federal government also offered many pandemic-era grants to hospitals so they could stay open, but those have run out. The Thomasville Hospital failed in part because it could not get any of those federal grants because it had not been open long enough. Miller says that as more rural hospitals close, communities' economies and their residents will suffer. The level to preventative care and responsiveness to emergencies will decrease in these communities, Miller predicts. We will end up with people who are getting more serious problems than they had before, and whenever they do end up getting care, it's a whole lot more expensive. Milestones page. We have two columns, and we have one, two, three, four other topics. Died Michael Madsen, M-A-D-S-E-N, Sexy Bad Guy by Stephanie Zakarik. Everyone wants to play the hero, but that only opens the playing field for suave, bad guy actors like Michael Madsen, who died July 3 at age 67. Madsen built a career playing funny, sexy thugs, most notably for Quentin Tarantino, as the louche bad boy Bud, 2Ds, in the Kill Bill saga. He meets a comically nasty end at the fangs of a poisonous snake. His unhinged Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs performs a silky smooth shuffle to Steeler Wheels Stuck in the Middle with You before taking a straight razor to the ear of a kidnapped cop. Madsen worked across four decades, often playing the sort of guy you would not want to meet in a dark alley, though you would always be happy to see him on screen. He also published several volumes of poetry. I Can Still Run Faster Than a Speeding Bullet, and I Know Superman Had a Cigarette Once in a While, he once wrote, suggesting he could be just as tender as he was tough. Convicted Sean Diddy Combs in Sex Crime Trial with Mixed Verdicts by Chantel Lee. Sean Diddy Combs, a music mogul whose weeks-long trial garnered global attention, was convicted on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, but acquitted on the other more serious charges he was facing, sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. The stunning verdict, July 2, came after nearly 2 months of emotional, graphic testimony from multiple witnesses, including Combs' ex-girlfriend Cassandra Cassie Ventura, whose allegations of physical and sexual abuse helped spur the federal investigation into the music mogul that led to his arrest in September. The prosecution alleged Combs manipulated and forced women to engage in sexual activities with male sex workers, which he called freak-offs. In their testimonies, Ventura and another woman who went by the pseudonym Jane said Combs pressured them to participate in these encounters. Upon hearing the verdict, Combs, who had pleaded not guilty to all charges, could be seen putting his hands together in a prayer stance and mouthing, "Thank you," to the jurors, according to court reporters. The judge overseeing the case declined to grant Combs bail, meaning the disgraced performer and producer will remain in custody until his sentencing hearing. The prosecution has said Combs faces up to 20 years in prison. The two counts he was convicted on carry a maximum sentence of 10 years each. Ventura's attorney, Douglas Wigdor, said in a statement after the verdict that although Combs was acquitted of sex trafficking his client, Ventura had paved the way for a jury to find Combs guilty of transportation to engage in prostitution. By coming forward with her experience, Cassie has left an indelible mark on both the entertainment industry and the fight for justice, he said. All right, now we're at the column of the short items announced by Anna Wintour, June 26. She will step down as American Vogue's editor-in-chief after leading the magazine for nearly four decades. She remains chief content officer at Condé Nast and global editorial director of Vogue. Posted Linda Yaccarino's announcement on social media platform X, July 9, she is stepping down as its CEO. Yaccarino led the Elon Musk-owned company, previously known as Twitter, for 2 years. Convicted an Australian woman, Erin Patterson, July 7, of murdering three of her estranged husband's relatives and attempting to kill another by serving them a meal containing poisonous mushrooms in 2023. Died Norman Tebbit, British Conservative politician who served in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet, July 7. He was 94. Televangelist Jimmy Swaggart, who was brought down by scandal July 1 at 90. Swaggart, the cousin of rock and roll pioneer Jerry Lee Lewis, sermonized against such music. The brief news, Recharging the Green Transition by Natalie Donbach. The minerals found in an electric car battery often travel thousands of miles around the world before the vehicles they will be in hit the road. Lithium mined in Chile or Argentina is shipped to China, where three-quarters of the world's electric vehicle EV batteries are currently made. The sea journey emits considerable amounts of CO2 in the process, yet electrifying the transportation sector, which accounts for more than a third of global CO2 emissions, is key for reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Putting more EVs on the roads and renewable energy in our grids will require more minerals, such as lithium, nickel, and cobalt, to power the batteries they rely on. According to the International Energy Agency, IEA, lithium demand has risen threefold since 2020 and is expected to triple again over the next decade. The overall demand for critical minerals for EVs is expected to grow sixfold by 2040. The question is, where will they come from? Currently, the EU imports 4/5 of its extracted lithium and 100% of its processed lithium. While most of it's mined in Australia and South America, about 3/4 of the world's lithium is processed in China. But there's a growing push to build an EV battery industry in Europe and North America by recycling lithium-ion batteries. EV batteries really represent one of the first times we can truly have a circular economy, says Alexis Georgeson, government relations executive at Redwood Materials, the largest lithium battery recycler in the U.S. In contrast to materials like paper and plastic, the metal atoms of lithium or nickel can be infinitely recycled. If you take them out of a battery, that nickel atom is still there, and you can refine it, purify it, put it back into a battery, and it's going to perform just as well, if not better, she says. Recycling is a question not only of meeting rising demand, but also of building a local supply chain. Amid the trade war with the U.S., China has restricted exports of critical minerals. While President Trump has been championing fossil fuels, he's also trying to get his hands on more critical minerals, including through a deal this year with Ukraine. But the benefits of recycling EV batteries extend way beyond national interest. It's also more sustainable than constantly mining for new minerals. A recent Stanford-led study showed the current industrial-scale process of recycling EV batteries emits less than half the greenhouse gases and uses only 1/4 the water and energy as mining new minerals, especially in locations with abundant renewable energy. While the EV market is still fairly new and growing, current models and batteries will need to be retired when they reach the end of their life in the coming decades, making recycling a key strategy to deal with them, says Zhi Chen, an assistant professor in energy and environment at City University of Hong Kong and one of the co-authors of the study. China, which was an early adopter of electrification, accounts for 80% of global EV battery recycling capacity. Meanwhile, Europe and North America are still in the early phases of developing battery recycling markets, which initially require large amounts of investment, experts say. Recycling involves carefully collecting disposed batteries, which are highly flammable, dismantling and discharging them. The batteries then go through a shredding process that generates so-called black mass, the shiny metallic mixture from which metals can be extracted. By using either pyrometallurgy, a heat-based process that practically roasts the batteries, or hydrometallurgy, which uses chemicals to separate the metals. The current refining processes are still quite rough, and there's lots of room to improve and really make the process more efficient, says Chen. EU policymakers are looking to support the still nascent industry through a new set of regulations mandating producers to recover lithium from 50% of waste batteries by the end of 2027, going up to 80% by the end of 2031. They also establish mandatory minimum levels of recycled content for batteries, including 16% for cobalt and 6% for lithium and nickel. While many recyclers currently stop at producing black mass, redwood materials, which is led by Tesla co-founder J.B. Straubel, is going further, specializing in cathode active material, which makes up the positive electrode of a battery, as well as most of its cost. We are producing products that can actually go further downstream, back to battery manufacturers. You cannot send lithium to a gigafactory. They have no use for it, says Georgeson. The automotive industry is exploring recycling, too. Last year, the German luxury car maker Porsche launched a pilot to explore how it could recycle its own lithium batteries and produce high-performance and long-lasting battery cells with recycled content, says Jonathan Hertz, the head of strategy for circular economy at Porsche. If we really want to do sustainable electromobility in Europe, we need the recycling part, he says. Next, making Pope Leo. How a Kid from the Midwest Became the Leader of the Catholic Church by Belinda Luscombe, Chicago. This is a two-page photo spread. The photo from the cover is on it with Mrs. Prevost and her three small sons. There are more that look like school pictures, maybe. A graduation photo, a photo next to Pope Benedict, that would have been. Little kids at the beach, three little boys in a row. And this is a photographer's photo because they're quite staged and they're smiling at the camera. Then there's a young man who looks like he might be in college, and he's seated casually, short-sleeved shirt and gray trousers. He's got a lot of dark hair. And he might be, I don't know, thinking about something or studying something. And then there are a couple of more. It looks like Robert Prevost stars in both of them. Again, this is by Belinda Luscombe in Chicago. Let's see if anybody else contributed. Nope, I guess not. Okay, I'm going to turn the page now to the text. This is under the heading Religion. There's another photo here of a house, Prevost's childhood home in Dalton, D-O-L-T-O-N, Illinois, where a current neighbor sometimes plays sermons. Oh, dear. Sermons through loudspeakers. It's a small bungalow. It looks like a typical Chicago older suburban bungalow. It's brick. It has a bright red front door, slate gray roof. It has a set of three windows in the front on one side and one window on the other. Green grass leading up to it next to the sidewalk. It does look like it has a new concrete front stoop leading up to that red door. I'm ticked, says John Prevost, the retired Midwestern high school principal, who is now abruptly and without warning globally famous and in demand. I didn't want to be, but I'm so angry. He is sitting at the table of Denise and Rob Utter, who've invited a bunch of people from their local Catholic parish, about 45 minutes south of Chicago, to talk about their friend and John's kid brother Bob, whom they've known for decades, over pizza. Sometimes they call him Father Bob. Occasionally they remember to call him by his new name, Pope Leo XIV. But it is unfamiliar to their tongue. One of the guests accidentally calls him Pope Pius. It's probably not all fun and games to be the spiritual leader of 1.4 billion people from very different cultures at a time when the Catholic Church is recovering from multiple scandals riven from within, financially and snarled, and especially in the so-called developed nations, wrestling with a growing disinterest in the stuff it does best: ancient ritual, obligatory gathering, biblical exegesis. But it's also a teensy bit of a drag to be his brother. Pope Leo XIV, 69, is the person to whom lots of people look when they want to come in contact with God. John Prevost, 71, is the person to whom they look when they want to reach the Pope. His mailbox is inundated. A local accounting firm sent him a 30-page pitch deck on how it would sort out the Vatican's finances. Another opportunist sent him two baseballs, asking for them to be forwarded to His Holiness, newly anointed as the world's most famous White Sox fan. Dear Mr. Prevost, please have your brother sign these baseballs, the accompanying letter said, according to its recipient. You can keep one and run a fundraiser. His mail carrier is sympathetic, advising him to hire someone to handle the paper blizzard. It is not just mail. His phone, a landline, rings well into the night. One recent warm day, Prevost was watering his yard when he noticed people at his front door. It was congregants from a now-shuttered church in Chicago, St. Adalbert's. They had a two-page letter to send to the Pope in hopes he will convince the cardinal to reopen the church, and they were not going to give up, he says. Even Hollywood's getting in on the act. Prevost, by the way, that's spelled P-R-E-V-O-S-T, has already had a showbiz publicist offer to represent him, and a journalist stop by post-interview to give him tips on what is imprudent to say on live TV, such as his imminent travel plans. Prevost travels are TRAVAILS, are one of the many ripple effects of May 8, 2025, when the conclave made several types of history by handing the papal keys to recently appointed American cardinal. Robert Francis Prevost is not only the first Augustinian, the first modern missionary, the first devotee of Pepys and Hostess Snowballs to occupy the throne of St. Peter. He's also the first leader from a land where opportunism and entrepreneurship are admired only slightly less than the triune God. America's not used to having a local guy as the driving force of an institution with four times as much history and even greater capacity to inspire fear and awe. But a deep dive into Pope Leo's education and background shows that either by divine intervention, wise choices, luck, or all three, his path made him uniquely prepared for steering through the choppy waters facing the ancient denomination he now leads. As recently as 3 months ago, it was a truth universally acknowledged that there was not going to be a pope from the U.S. anytime soon. The Americans were too dominant elsewhere, too loud, too confident, too greedy, too obsessed with individual liberties. They venerated the new and the shiny, performing novel and homegrown faiths to the traditions of Europe or Asia. they were more concerned with LGBTQ rights and the ordination of women than the plight of the poor and dispossessed. But if ever there were going to be an American pope, people could have predicted he'd have come from the Midwest. "He's Midwestern nice," says Father Paul Galletto, pastor of St. Paul Church in Philadelphia. Of the fellow Augustinian, he's known since his 20s. "He listens to you. He's pleasant. He's not going to jump in the middle of your conversation, tell you you are wrong. That's a great advantage for him." Even the much prevailed upon John Prevost can't stay ticked for long. A few minutes or a few evenings before our dinner party, someone left a package at his doorstep. It was a Wordle, W-O-R-D-L-E, cap. He plays Wordle with his Vatican-based brother every day. He in English, the Pope in Italian. And then here comes the card. "Dear John, in a world where there are so many evil people right now, you are a breath of fresh air. Thank you," says Prevost. "We are so appreciative of your sense of humor and your kind words." And that changed my attitude. People are watching me, so I'd better not be crabby. It was clear from very early on where the youngest of Mildred and Louis Prevost's young sons, three sons, was heading. The only thing that was in question until eighth grade was, would it be an order priest or would it be a diocesan priest, says John. The former belongs to a brotherhood while the latter serves a church. Nothing was forced on him. That was his decision to make. The family were eager Catholics. His mother, a school librarian, sang in the choir, as did young Robert. They had relatives who were nuns. Before he became a high school principal and district superintendent, Lewis, who served in the Navy during World War II, had considered being a priest. His son's career choices mirrored their father's. Lewis, the oldest, named after his dad, went into the Navy. John was a principal of Catholic high schools, and Robert took the path his father might have taken. Apart from his devotion to the church and the fact that study came easily to him, Robert was a regular kid, riding his bike around the streets of the South Chicago working-class suburb of Dalton by day, playing flashlight tag by night, occasionally squeezing the glowing goo out of fireflies and wiping it on an older brother. It did not seem odd. He occasionally set up a pretend communion table on the ironing board and gave his family play sacraments. John confirms that even while very young, Robert had a reputation among the neighbors, with one elderly lady telling him as they played in the yard, he would be Pope one day. When young men showed an inclination toward entering the priesthood in 1967 Chicago, a city that was Catholic enough that locals identified themselves by their parish rather than their neighborhood, they would be visited by representatives of various orders, football scout style, to see where they might fit in. I remember sitting around a table each time someone was coming, and they would come, and then everyone would ask questions, said John Prevost. We had to sit there and be nice. The vocational director who persuaded 8th grade Robert to give the Augustinians a spin was Dudley Day, a Catholic of the old school, whose views were conservative enough that he later parted ways with his local church over a disagreement about modernization. St. Augustine, the minor seminary in Holland, Michigan, where Robert Prevost completed his secondary education, was the kind of place that sorted the priests from the merely pious. About 50 boys were accepted every year, and about a dozen graduated 4 years later. It was tough. It was rigorous, says Father Beckett Franks, who was a year above the future pope at school. Students were up at 6 a.m. and had scheduled activities until about 8:30 p.m., when they had a few hours of free time before retiring to a large dormitory lined with beds. There was prayer three times a day, and a lot of time in close quarters together. Prevost, who was co-valedictorian and yearbook editor, among other accolades, had a reputation for being a good person to turn to for help with homework, especially math or languages. "He was the smartest person I think we ever met," says Franks, who's now a Benedictine monk and chaplain. He had mastered French by the middle of high school. Students were required to undertake certain extracurricular activities. Prevost was in the choir with Franks. Both sang tenor and played tennis, and to keep up their academic performance. But mostly the school's focus was how to live in community. "Everything that we went through at St. Augustine Seminary High School prepared Robert Prevost for his position," says Franks. "Not just education, but dealing with people and learning patience and how to behave." From Michigan, Prevost went to Villanova, the Augustinian University just outside Philadelphia. It was in Pennsylvania that he really developed his love of driving, which, according to two contemporaries, he would do while reading a book. He and three friends once asked Father Bill Sullivan, who oversaw would-be friars, if they could drive to a church dance in Chicago, some 12 hours away, and be back the following afternoon, in January. Their request was declined. "He was just an easy guy to be with," says Sullivan, now a parochial vicar at St. Jude's, the church the Utters belonged to, in New Lenox, Illinois. "He made friends. People really listened to him. Prevost majored in math and minored in philosophy, but it was pretty much the end of his study of anything not directly related to his faith. In September 1977, shortly after he finished his coursework at Villanova, he made the first round of vows to join the Augustinian order. At 22, Robert Prevost was committing his life to an establishment in the midst of generational change. The Catholic Church of his parents had been altered profoundly by the Second Vatican Council, which released a series of reports in the mid-60s, loosening up some of the Church's strictures and establishing a series of new procedures and rules that allowed, among other things, Mass to be said in languages that were not Latin, and pastoral care for those who are divorced. One result of these changes was a call for a new style of urban and more ecumenical Catholic university. Prevost joined an institution founded on those principles. The Catholic Theological Union, CTU, housed in the former Aragon Hotel, was a decade old when Prevost arrived. Two dozen or so men's orders studied there, as well as women and lay people, and the school had female professors and a rabbi on staff. What it did not have was any students on the way to becoming diocesan priests. They trained in the more palatial Mundelein Seminary outside Chicago. The mix of cultures, genders, orders, and the shedding of hierarchy, professors were called by the first names, made it an exciting place to be. It was, in a certain sense, the best of what religious community can become, says Sister Diane Burgant, 88, who taught there for 45 years. Burgant marveled at the opportunity she was giving. "This is going to sound like an exaggeration, but I do not ever remember being minimized by my male colleagues because I was a woman," she says. "Women were considered to be theologians in the same way as men." She had Prevost in two classes, Old Testament and Pentateuch, and does not remember him at all, but can tell from her class notes that he did well and always turned in his assignments on time. Each student had a spiritual director, and Prevost chose Sister Lynn Osiak, who also supervised his theological reflection class. "Calm and steady," says Osiak. "Those are the two words I'd say about him. it was like nothing fazed him. He was really a person who was at peace with himself. The scholarship at CTU was both rigorous and progressive. One of the required classes on Christology had two versions, one taught by a professor trained by Edward Schillebeeks, the respected Belgian theologian who promulgated the idea the true role of the Christian was not to ascribe to a certain set of beliefs, but to write in justice, as Jesus did. And the other, trained by the equally respected German theologian Karl Rahner, whose emphasis was on the mystical nature of Christ, and thus of all humans. Wherever Prevost has gone, he's been among men who had been trained as he was and committed to sharing everything. Even when he was a cardinal with his own papal apartment, he went to the Augustinian Curia for meals and mass every day, and once a week to play tennis. He dined there at least twice in the early weeks of his papacy. He was very interested in what I was doing in Peru, says Turley, who worked there 52 years. While other students were heading to their rooms to study, Prevost wanted to talk about what people in Turley's diocese needed. Of all of them, he was the most community-minded, says Turley. If Prevost spent most of his first quarter century less than 800 miles from his home, the decades that followed would take him quite a bit further. After he graduated from CTU and took his solemn vows in 1981, he was invited to study canon law in Rome. While Prevost was studying a historic and doctrinaire subject, essentially the legal framework for the Catholic Church's operations at the Angelicum, a 440-year-old school where Pope John Paul II had studied, he was surrounded by the excitement of a new era. The Augustinian house was across St. Peter's Square from the Vatican, and it was filled with men from around the world. When you study in Rome, you realize the church is really universal. Many of the Augustinians who were in the United States, we just think the American problems are the church's problems. But there's so much more than that. While Pope Leo owes his formal education almost solely to the Northern Hemisphere, much of his shaping as a practitioner occurred in Peru. After a decade in South America, it must have been quite an adjustment to take on the role of head of his home, Augustinian province, which stretches throughout the Midwest and into Canada. One of his duties as provincial prior was to minister to Augustinian schools, and he was called in to help out St. Rita of Casha High School in Chicago. The students have a retreat every year, and the school likes to invite priests who are unfamiliar to the boys to hear confession so they don't feel awkward. In 2000, Prevost was one of the priests. I had gone to confession several times before, but it was like 2 minutes. Let me get out of here as quickly as I can, says Patrick P.J. McCarthy. But this was more of just a conversation. The two sat knee to knee in the darkened room and talked about underage drinking and sibling rivalry, among other things. He was not judging me. He was very open, recalls McCarthy. Mike Stowski, who was on retreat as a student leader, noticed right away Prevost was different from most priests. What was so fascinating about him was that almost immediately we forgot he wasn't with us the whole time. He was so welcoming, so caring for what we were doing. After 2 years, Prevost was voted in as head or prior general of all Augustinians, based again in Rome. He traveled a lot, encouraging other 2,800 or so Augustinian friars around the world. But priors generally serve only 2 terms, and in 2013, Prevost found himself back in Chicago, back at CTU. helping guide Augustinians in training, work usually done by much younger men. It's like having the CEO of an international organization retire from being CEO, but yet be employed by the organization for passing out mail, says Bergant, the Old Testament scholar. Prevost, if he felt it was a come-down, he said nothing. That's the Father Bob the folks of New Lenox talk about. Never too busy or too big for his community. After Father Mike Schweifler had a heart transplant on Easter in 2005, the women of St. Jude's who were looking after him struggled to get his brethren to visit. But Prevost, who was prior general, came several times. Sometimes he was just on a stopover, and he drove here from O'Hare for a few hours or a few minutes, says Denise Utter. Then he'd go back to O'Hare because he had a connecting flight. I'm skipping ahead here. In 2023, Prevost was made a cardinal and moved back to Vatican City, working in successively more prominent roles till the announcement of his election in May. He's been formed in the kind of church that is forward-thinking, missionary in its outlook, globally aware, and then, especially in Peru, very deeply informed by his accompaniment of people who were the poorest, says Sister Barbara Reed, current president of CTU. You can hear it in everything he says. Bob Prevost might never climb behind the wheel of a car again, but Pope Leo might be able to drive something. Already inquiries about becoming an Augustinian novitiate are up fivefold from last year. Augustinian websites have been flooded with traffic, and another type of visitor has been showing up on John Prevost's doorstep. People who feel that an American pope is a sign. Because of my brother, they're going back to the church, says the older Prevost. They say, I've been away for a long time, and I'd like to come back. And with a few minutes left, this article may be a bridge. The last one was a bridge somewhat. Politics, a seismic moment for the left, by Philip Elliott. The world's economic capital stands to have a democratic socialist at the helm. No, that is not some AI hallucination. That really happened in New York City's June 24 mayoral primary, when 33-year-old state assemblyman Zohran Mamdani from Queens prevailed over former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in a seismic moment that signals how much of an insurgent posture Democrats are in at the moment. Mamdani, that's M-A-M-D-A-N-I, who became an avatar for the political movement led by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, would be the first Muslim to lead New York. He cast himself as Donald Trump's worst nightmare, and a progressive champion poised to lead a deeply resourced grand experiment. As party leaders fret about whether Kamala Harris lost for being seen as too woke on various issues, the coastal deep blue enclaves are completely disconnected from that conversation and the party's dreadful standing on the national stage. Tonight is his night. He deserved it. He won, Cuomo said of Mamdani's showing. The 67-year-old member of a New York political dynasty soon re-entered the race as an independent, joining incumbent Mayor Eric Adams in sticking around on November's ballot. With strong showings in Brooklyn and Manhattan, Mamdani capped a shocking rise toward one of the most prominent jobs in U.S. politics. For many people, particularly those outside of America, there's the president, then maybe Speaker of the House. Sometimes Senate Majority Leader is in the pecking order. And then there's Mayor of New York City. To be clear, few establishment Democrats liked any of the viable options in the race. Mamdani's pro-Palestinian activism drew accusations of anti-Semitism. Cuomo was forced from the governor's gig amid accusations from at least 11 women. Cuomo has consistently denied the allegations of sexual harassment, but said he stepped down so the state could focus on governing rather than being consumed by a looming impeachment. And Adams, the incumbent, is his own ethical mess. Still, someone has to lead New York. Mamdani instantly becomes the ringleader of the resistance. As the elected chief of the nation's largest city, with a budget of $115 billion and 300,000 employees, he would command a platform that has few peers. But it also would be a tough test case. Can a democratic socialist effectively lead such a huge bureaucracy? Much like the likes of Ocasio-Cortez, Nancy Pelosi, and Hillary Clinton, Mamdani is about to become shorthand in the MAGAverse for right-wing attacks. And with the self-proclaimed label of democratic socialist, he's about to be an anchor that other fellow Democrats will have to deal with. But he could also be a model for Democrats in the second Trump era. If democratic socialists want to convince the electorate, they are ready for the national stage. New York City might be the best proving ground possible. And that actually was read in its entirety. And there is a small photo on the bottom of the page of Zohran, Z-O-H-R-A-N, Mamdani, M-A-M-D-A-N-I. A nice-looking younger fellow with slicked-back hair, dark facial hair, wearing a white shirt, a red tie, dark trousers, and he's rolling up his sleeve. Oh, and he's also smiling at the camera. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.